Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate vote to restore unemployment cuts for 1.3 million Americans that came into effect on December the 28th, and get an analysis of the myths about unemployment that the right-wing press and the Republicans are propagating. Craig Harrington, an economics researcher at Media Matters, joins us to refute the charges from the armchair comfort of wealthy pundits like George Will and Charles Krauthammer that the benefits have gone on too long, the economy is improving, and that the benefits cause a dependency amongst the unemployed, causing them to lose the incentive to find work. Then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and look into the murder of the former Miss Venezuela of 2004, who, along with her Irish husband, was gunned down on the side of a freeway after their car broke down. Their five-year-old daughter was wounded but is in stable condition. We will speak with David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who is the moderator of the Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights blog, and discuss why Venezuela has one of the highest murder rates in the world and why the government is apparently in denial about the lack of safety and security for its citizens. Then finally, after years of scandals and ongoing federal corruption investigations that have brought charges against 18 current and former deputies for beating inmates, obstructing the FBI, and other crimes, the Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Barker announced that he's retiring after 15 years in charge of the nation's largest jail system where these activities went on. Celeste Freeman, the founder and editor of Witness LA and author of G-Dog and the Homeboys, joins us to discuss whether Barker's retirement will head off possible federal indictments against him. Joining us now is Craig Harrington, an economic researcher at Media Matters who previously worked as a researcher and analyst focused on trade and economic policy reform. He has an article at MediaMatters.org, Media's latest unemployment myth, benefits have gone on too long. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Harrington.
Thank you for having me on.
And Craig, I must say, I just personally find it quite disgusting to see these armchair pundits like George Will and Krauthammer, who clearly are very wealthy men and, you know, powerful and well-connected and very skilled at what they do in terms of presenting right-wing propaganda. But the idea that they gratuitously beating up on the unemployed and smugly suggesting that somehow they're getting it too easy and getting a free ride is just something obscene about that. And here we are, observing the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty, and Republicans are creating poverty. They're cutting food stamps and cutting unemployment benefits. I don't understand it.
That's actually one of the sort of perverse side effects of the right-wing media, and then, of course, the right-wing political sphere that's enabled by that media. One of the side effects of their policy prescriptions is they continually say that, you know, anti-poverty programs are failing. They say that unemployment benefits are failing the unemployed because unemployment continues to be a problem. And you know, you'll have someone like Rand Paul who will write an op-ed incorrectly citing a study that stated that long-term unemployment beneficiaries have a harder time finding work than people who are not long-term unemployment beneficiaries. And he said, well, that's because they're receiving benefits, when in fact it's because they've been unemployed for so long. The way to correct these unemployment issues, the way to fix the broken labor market, isn't to kick people off of unemployment. It isn't to kick people out of food stamps. It isn't to stop funding anti-poverty measures. It's to create jobs programs through directed policy. That's what all of the economists are saying, and that's the thing that the right-wing media and the conservative political sphere simply ignore.
And, of course, economists will almost universally tell you that taking money out of a faltering economy or an economy that has not yet recovered, like the food stamps money, which is immediately spent and goes back into the economy, and like unemployment benefits that's immediately spent and goes back into the economy, is in itself counterintuitive.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we've seen. You know, when you look at the decisions made by the Federal Open Market Committee at the Federal Reserve, they've continually had this quantitative easing purchasing program where they're spending $85 billion, now $75 billion every month buying mortgage assets in the economy to try to boost the financial sector in hopes that that will trickle down. And every time that they do this, they issue in their policy statements that the reason they need to continue their asset purchases is because of what they call fiscal drag in the economy. And because the Federal Reserve is a nonpartisan entity, they can't say it's because Republicans are sabotaging economic progress. But when you look at the economics and the econometrics behind it, what you find is that every time we make a step forward, we take a step back. You know, the economy has been growing in 2013 and 2012, 2011, but it's growing slower than it could be. And in economics, it's just opportunity cost loss. Media Matters has been following this for a long time. Our economic team has covered this many times. And the problem is, when we're not instituting good policies and we're not taking the advice of economists, and in fact, we have a report out today showing economists are only 4% of the guests in economics news segments. So when the media is bringing people out to talk about economic issues and try to have economic perspectives, they're not talking to experts. If they were talking to the experts, they'd know that the government needs to get out of the way. It needs to stop cutting back on these programs. It needs to take some sort of stimulative effort and try to boost the economy. When you can increase demand, you increase that consumer engine, and you let the economy grow naturally. Instead, we just keep cutting along the edges out of this idea that we're going to fix the budget by, you know, cutting food stamps for starving kids and retirees, or that we're going to solve our long-term budget issues by cutting unemployment for 1.3 million people. But really, you're just increasing hardship for those people without solving any issues.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Harrington, the economic researcher at Media Matters, who previously worked as a researcher and analyst focused on trade and economic policy reform. He has an article at MediaMatters.org, Media's Latest Unemployment Myth, Benefits Have Gone On Too Long. So the 60-37 vote in the Senate gets over that procedural hurdle, the filibuster hurdle that they've been using to shut down just about everything in the Senate, the Republicans. So it's uncertain, of course, both McConnell the minority leader of the Senate and Boehner in the House say they want to offset any unemployment benefits with some cut somewhere else. And of course, we've had this whole budget process, which was done in private with Senator Patty Murray and Representative Paul Ryan, and they've come up with a deal that basically restores a lot of the cuts to defense that came in the sequester. So in other words, the defense budget, which is already obscenely bloated, still at greater than the Cold War levels when we had a real enemy, the Soviet Union, everybody agrees that they got to have a break. And we're talking about billions and billions of extra on top of the hundreds of billions that they have. And we're talking about a 3 month extension for unemployment benefits that costs what? $20 billion or something?
Extending the unemployment benefits through 2014 would be about $25 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And when you listen to conservative politicians and conservative media pundits, they point out that they want to have that offset. But it's important to note, and right-wing politicians and right-wing media are happy to point this out, the Democrats and the Republicans agreed on this Murray-Ryan budget agreement. And in the Murray-Ryan budget, which the president signed, it did not include an increase or a further extension of unemployment benefits. So if you're looking for offsetting the cost of those benefits with defense cuts, the Republicans have already stonewalled that. They've already created this budget procedure that was signed into law that will allow them to avoid going into the defense industry or into other areas to make those cuts. If we do, in fact, reinstate the emergency unemployment compensation for people who are part of the long-term unemployed, that money is almost certainly going to have to come out of cutting somewhere else. And it's very unlikely that it's going to come out of one of those sacred cows like defense, because that's something that the Republicans specifically protected in this budget negotiation. So if we, in fact, get a vote in the Senate to extend the emergency unemployment compensation, and if that goes to the House, where it almost certainly will be stonewalled by Republican opposition, but the only way it has a chance is by cutting somewhere else. And you're talking about education, you're talking about food stamp funding, you're talking about something, some discretionary program that helps Americans, that employs Americans, is going to have to get cut in order to put money into another program that helps and employs Americans as well.
So what happened here, given that the president has spoken out, and there have been a number of voices of disgust at what's happening, that this sort of gratuitous punishment of the already unemployed who are being punished enough by this economy that was the crash of which was caused by Wall Street. The Wall Street's been made whole. You mentioned the QE quantitative easing, the $85 billion a month. A lot of that paper that they're buying up is the worthless paper that got us into the trouble in the first place. But they're making the banks whole, but Main Street languishing. And the president is meeting with the families of the unemployed in the White House. So he seems to have gotten the message here. Why did they make such a lousy deal and now find themselves in a situation where they're saying that there's nowhere, you know, that there's no way we can rob Peter to pay Paul?
Well, it would seem in some ways that the budget deal that was hammered out by Patty Murray and Paul Ryan was almost created out of necessity because of the fact that we went to a shutdown in October. And that was one thing that both sides wanted to avoid. The president, you know, came out politically ahead of Republicans on the shutdown, and Democrats finished ahead of the president on the shutdown. But everyone lost face with the American public. The shutdown was extremely unpopular. And if we didn't get a budget negotiation, if we didn't have a negotiated budget agreement come out of this bipartisan caucus, it's almost certain that we would have gone back into shutdown sometime in January or February. And if that were the case, everyone would lose politically. So what it seems like is that everyone wanted to avoid going into that. And one of the things that just had to be sacrificed so that they could save political face was unemployment benefits. The hope was always to reinstate them somewhere else. But now that there's going to have to be this sort of guaranteed cut included in the benefits, it's hard to see where that $25 billion will come from. If we were sensible and we were making reasonable fiscal policy, we would simply pay for it at a time when interest rates are zero and money is virtually free for the U.S. government. We would finance this $25 billion in debt, build the economy through the stimulation that goes from that program into the consumer economy, and then pay for it with an increased tax receipts, increased employment, and decreased reliance on other federal benefits programs. But we don't have sensible fiscal policy in Washington. What we have is just this crisis-driven narrative, and that leaves us with unemployment benefits being cut for 1.3 million Americans who don't deserve this kind of punishment.
And meanwhile, you've got the Club for Growth and the Heritage Action lobbies that are being funded by the Koch brothers and other billionaires, saying, warning their Republican colleagues not to cave in on unemployment benefits because they're a free lunch. And again, we're talking about $25 billion in the overall scheme of things, which is absolutely a drop in the bucket. How about farm subsidies? I mean, you have this congressman from Tennessee who has been quoting the Bible, saying that he who does not work doesn't deserve to be fed, and yet his family receives hundreds of, millions from the federal government in crop subsidies. Or perhaps we should put the unemployed in the military, just give them a temporary commission in the United States military. What? Is there any creative way to get around this obscenity of small change, $25 billion, yet 1.3 million people depend upon it, and they've been hurt after Christmas, and there's going to be another 1.9 million cut off in the middle of the year, I understand?
It's actually important and interesting that you brought up the farm subsidies, because part of the farm bill ever since 1949 had been that a food stamp initiative had been attached to the farm bill. Food stamps didn't exist as they exist now in the 1940s and 50s, but there was a similar program that existed as a sort of pilot initiative. And what we've seen for almost 50 years, or over 50 years, is that the farm bill had always included this food stamps, so that rural and urban constituencies could be tied together, so that this spending policy for two different and seemingly unrelated areas of the economy could be directed to help both of them. And what we saw in the House of Representatives in the autumn, in late 2013, was a decoupling of food stamps from the Farm Bill. And so we passed a Farm Bill, and we passed farm subsidies, and Democrats agreed to it, or it was allowed to proceed through, because, you know, we need a Farm Bill, we need an agricultural policy. But Republicans in Congress, in a lot of ways, emboldened by the right-wing media, were able to pry food stamps out of the Farm Bill for the first time in history. And so now we have food stamps languishing on the chopping block, and that's something that serves 48 million Americans. And it's a death by a thousand cuts. Every budget item that they can possibly pry away, or they can possibly take down, or they can possibly cut around the edges, they will, because they're emboldened by people who want to ostensibly cut the deficit. And of course, the real argument in favor of cutting all these programs is, if you're anti-government, if you're the anti-government policy, you don't want government to work well, and you want its programs to serve as few people as possible. And that's what we see.
Well, apparently, the figure that I'm just reading now is that this extension of 3 months that the Senate just passed, but as we've discussed, the House and the Senate Republicans want to offset it with cuts somewhere else. Apparently, the three month extension is only costing $6.4 billion.
It's true,
and so that's what we're talking about: $6.4 billion.
The current 3 month extension, which is something that would really be the last straw for many conservative politicians and conservative media pundits, the last thing they're willing to give up is another 3 months. It's about $6 billion, but it's not actually the cost of the line item budget. You know, this is a program that stimulates the economy. Money that goes out in unemployment benefits is spent by unemployed people who are currently looking for work. It's spent immediately. It is their, in many cases, entire cash income. So the idea that it costs money is sort of irrelevant, because it goes into the consumer economy and it has a multiplier effect, and it stimulates job creation, it stimulates economic productivity, and it comes back to the government in tax receipts. But of course, in the right-wing media and in right-wing political circles, they just disagree with basic economic principles like the multiplier effect. They don't agree that if you pump money into the consumer economy, that money will return through tax receipts and economic growth. So they're talking about a tiny figure. You know, we have a $3.9 trillion federal budget annualized, and we're talking about $6 billion. We're talking about far less than 1%. We're talking about almost 1% of 1%, and that's what we're fighting over. But the real effects on the ground is that millions of people will be affected. There are 1.3 million people who have lost benefits already, and if those benefits don't get reinstated, there's really nothing that they can do. And right now in Washington, the fight is over whether or not we're going to cut that $6 billion out of the National Science Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, or some other area, so that we can help unemployed workers stay surviving in a very, very difficult labor market.
Well, again, it's the people, the messengers in this case, these very comfortable people, these well-off people who are so heartless and hypocritical in pointing out, in blaming, in effect, our fiscal woes on these unfortunate victims of this economy that was destroyed by their main sponsors and backers, the Wall Street bankers. It's pretty hard to take this the idea that the sky is falling from the deficit. And I'm sorry, but we've got to, you know, we got to make cuts somewhere. And too bad, you know, you're the freeloaders and you're out of luck. I mean, it's obscene when you think about it, and I just don't understand. Is the fact that the president and after the Democrats made this disgraceful sellout deal, and I understand the reasons for it, which was you don't want the government to shut down again, but maybe, you know, it's necessary for the government to shut down again if the right people are blamed for the shutdown. And now, of course, the pendulum swung the other way. Obama's in trouble because of the botched rollout of healthcare.gov. So, anyway, I'm rambling on here. Just a final thought from you to shut me up.
Well, that's actually perfectly interesting. You know, one of the things that we saw during the shutdown is that the rollout of a website, which was glitchy and has now mostly been fixed, was completely ignored by the media, which was focused on the shutdown. So if you're a Republican or if you're a member of the right-wing media, you don't want another shutdown because it'll take away the only talking point you have left. There's no social policy, there's no fiscal policy, there's no monetary policy, there's no foreign policy. Nothing's being provided by the right wing other than that they hate Obamacare. And that's what they're hoping will embolden them in 2014, and they're largely being invigorated in this by a media sphere, a right-wing media sphere, that is fact-free. You know, we at Media Matters continually work 24 hours a day fact-checking right-wing media because they forward lies and fabrications and just blatant falsehoods as if it was backed by evidence. Their argument that we need to cut unemployment is just a perfect example of it. They say that unemployment benefits increase the unemployment rate. Well, that's true, because in order to receive benefits, you have to technically be attached to the labor force. You have to be looking for a job. When we continue the cuts of unemployment, which went into effect on December 28th, if these don't get reinstated before the next monthly jobs report comes out in February, what we will see is a decrease in the unemployment rate. And the right-wing media will say, oh, well, look, these people went out and found jobs. In fact, what they did was become detached from the labor force. And the unemployment rate will drop because fewer people will be a part of the labor force. And so the actual number of people who are unemployed, who are technically unemployed and looking for work, will drop. But that doesn't mean that we'll actually have put anyone to work. It'll just mean that we kicked people out of the system. And they're not going to report that.
Well, Craig Harrington, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Harrington, an economic researcher at Media Matters, who previously worked as a researcher and analyst focused on trade and economic policy reform. He has an article at MediaMatters.org, Media's Latest Unemployment Myth, Benefits Have Gone On Too Long. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is David Smaldi, who is a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela. And Professor Smaldi has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He's currently working on a book called Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights under Chavez, 2008 to 2012, and is the moderator of the Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights blog. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smaldi.
Thank you for having me.
And I imagine in Venezuela now, the unfortunate tragedy of a former Venezuelan beauty queen, Monica Spear, 29 years old, along with her husband, Thomas Berry, an Irishman. They've been shot dead in their car, and their 5-year-old daughter was also injured in this incident. Apparently, she's in stable condition. Venezuela does seem to produce an inordinate number of Miss Worlds and beauty queens. What's the local reaction to the death of Miss Venezuela, who also ran for Miss Universe in 2004?
Well, of course, it's been a major news story all day. This is the type of thing that happens at least weekly. That's, you know, somewhere somebody has car trouble and gets murdered or robbed or whatever on the side of the road. The difference here is that it's a beauty queen and not only Beauty Queen, but a very well-known actress that works in Venezuelan telenovelas. And so it's caused a lot of consternation, and it's been, discussed in the media, and it's caused a lot of reflection on what it means, you know, for this much violence to be happening in Venezuela.
And this happened on a major highway, right, between Valencia and Puerto Cabello?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a major highway with constant traffic on it. You know, it's relatively isolated. The area is not the type of place you want to break down. But this is a highway I've driven up and down many times.
So, what's the attitude that Venezuelans have about this high crime rate, which is, I think, amongst the highest in the world, certainly in the hemisphere?
Yeah, well, it's been a problem in Venezuela, really, for 20 years. No, it's been the number one citizen issue in Venezuela. However, it's gotten much worse during the Chavez government. And, you know, the government basically continually says, well, this is just, you know, media sensationalism, that this is a political issue that people, you know, that the opposition is trying to create. And, of course, that's true. This is something that the opposition to the government tries to dwell on because it is a government weakness. But, of course, that doesn't mean it's not true. There has been a real substantial increase in this kind of crime during the Chavez government and now during the Maduro government. So it's an issue. It's the sort of the leading issue of everyday discussion, you know, in every day in Venezuela.
So what is the attitude then of the Venezuelan government, now headed by Chavez's successor, Maduro? What's their excuse? Are they in denial?
Well, I think, you know, for a long time, it's interesting, you know, the government was in denial for many years under the Chavez government, because it came with a very sort of a Marxist view of violence, that crime and violence come from inequality and poverty. And so the Chavez government always thought, if we could just address poverty and inequality, then violence and crime is just going to disappear on its own. Of course, any criminologist will tell you that it doesn't actually work that way. Oftentimes, an improving economy can coincide with a crime wave. And in fact, that's exactly what happened with Venezuela. They made progress on poverty and they made progress on inequality, and crime skyrocketed. And the reason that happens is that, you know, when you have economic dynamism and change, oftentimes you also have social change and sort of social instability. And you also have a lot of money in the street, and that generates all the conditions that you need for crime. And so it took the government a while to really realize this. During the last 5 years of the Chavez government, they actually made an interesting push in terms of police reform. However, these things take a long time, and they haven't really had much success in actually, you know, reducing the crime rate. During the Maduro government, you know, the 1 year or so of the Maduro government, what he has done is he's gone much more towards the traditional Venezuelan way of policing and had brought out the military into the streets to try and address citizen security. Of course, they're very ineffective, and it has done very little so far. I mean, they know it's a problem. They're not quite sure what to do. In part they're trying to do things, but in part they're also in public denial about it.
Again, I'm speaking with David Smildy, who is in Caracas, Venezuela. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela. He's also a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia and currently working on a book called Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights under Chavez, 2008 to 2012, and is the moderator of the Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights blog. So I've spoken to reporters for The Guardian and the BBC in Venezuela, who have covered the prison situation, and it's apparently quite scary. I mean, I think 250,000 plus in prison that are heavily armed. The prisons are run by armed gangs, and it's as though there's an army of dangerous, you know, heavily armed anarchists waiting to burst out. Is it quite that bad?
Well, I think I think prison situation is very bad in Venezuela. It's not 250,000 that are in the prisons. It'd be, I think, a little less than 100,000. But the capacity for the prison system is probably about 30,000, and they probably have around 70,000 or 80,000. It's almost three times, you know, as many prisoners as they should have in there. And a lot of the prisons are basically, you know, there's some areas that are basically run by the prisoners themselves, and it's almost sort of anarchy within the prisons. That is actually related to the crime problem in the sense that some crime rings are actually directed from prisons, especially things like kidnapping, and also the sort of the really ineffective nature of the prison system means that oftentimes people, you know, don't go to jail but put on the street early, and there's absolutely no sort of reform that takes place in the prison system. So that is a really serious issue that's affecting the crime situation.
So the fact that right next door you have Colombia, which is the source of a lot of cocaine, and the cocaine cartels are always looking for safe harbors and havens and places to export their drugs and import their money. What role is Venezuela playing in that?
Well, yeah, Venezuela has Colombia next door, which is the world's leading producer of cocaine. At the same time, Venezuela has sort of broken with the United States and sort of international community in their drug interdiction efforts, at the same time that it sort of maintained the same model of trying to sort of intercept flights and reduce drug trafficking, et cetera. And so it's been extremely ineffective, and Venezuela has become a real sort of bridge for cocaine that comes from Colombia en route usually to Europe, but also the United States. And so that's really increased in Venezuela. It's had a real negative effect on public administration, especially on the armed forces, which, some sectors of the armed forces have become deeply involved in drug trafficking. That has some relationship to the crime problem. I think it's often exaggerated. I think the crime problem has much more relationship with just everyday sort of street crime and very ineffective deinstitutionalized police forces.
So again, I'm speaking with David Smildy in Caracas, Venezuela, and we initially was discussing the news that a former Venezuelan beauty queen, Monica Spear, who was crowned Miss Venezuela in 2008 and also ran for Miss Universe, was murdered along with her Irish husband, Thomas Berry, and their five-year-old daughter was also shot in the incident. Their car broke down on a major freeway in Venezuela. And at this point, I say the police seem to think it's some kind of robbery that went wrong. But since you spend so much time in Venezuela, what is your personal sense of security? I mean, do you look over your shoulder, or who can you depend upon in terms of, are the police doing their job? They don't appear to be, with given the high crime rate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. You know, even in Venezuela, even with very high crime rates, the basic dynamic is similar to the dynamic anywhere in the world, and that is that crime is not usually random. It's usually between people that know each other, and it's usually between gangs or between people that have some sort of turf war or some kind of revenge or vengeance going on. I mean, the cases like this one of Monica Spear are actually the exception. And so, you know, everybody gets affected by crime, but, basically watching where you're going, when you're going, not going out at late or going out late or putting yourself in dangerous places is what most people do. You know, it's what they do here. It's what they do in any sort of city that has a crime problem. I think, you know, it is true that police are, you know, very little trust of police officers here in Venezuela. You know, the opinion polling is very clear that people just don't trust the police. And that was, you know, I think people have good reason to not trust the police, because a lot of them, you know, are involved. The Minister of Justice a couple of years himself said that police were involved in 20% of all crime. I think it's probably actually higher than that. Not simply that they would be perpetrating crime, but a lot of crimes happen because criminals in a certain area will pay off the police. No, and policing is hard, but it's not rocket science. A lot of it happens because the police are in cahoots with the criminals, and that's why you have these sort of areas of anarchy that criminals can sort of act with free will.
Well, David Smildy, if this is one of the most important issues in Venezuelan society, and the one that concerns Venezuelan citizens more than anything else, is their lack of security and the high crime rate, what kind of public debate is going on? Because my understanding is that the broadcast media and television is entirely controlled now by the Chavistas.
Yeah, the I think that's, you know, it's true that especially television now, you know, the state media that strongly supports the government, and you have some media that's private that sort of studiously neutral. What you don't really have anymore are opposition media that report on these things. The radio dial, you do still have some opposition stations, although there's still the strong tendency to sort of self-censorship. You still have some opposition. Print media is still a wide open field, so there's plenty of discussion within print and print media about this type of thing. I think, you know, it's interesting. Citizen security, you know, more and more we're finding out, you know, this has been a problem since before Chavez, and a problem during Chavez government as well, but he never really paid a political price for that. And polling shows that the thing is people in Venezuela tend not to see crime as a public policy issue. They tend to see it as an issue of morality, as an issue of family, of neighborhoods. They tend to sort of blame themselves or blame the Venezuelan people for, you know, the crime rate. And so one of the reasons that the Chavez government was very slow to act and respond to this is that they didn't pay a political price. Now, that's been changing slowly on, but still, you ask in opinion polls, and we have a couple pieces on the blog about this, you know, in the past couple of months, you ask in opinion polls, you know, who's to blame, and you know, the majority answer is still going to say the family. You know, that's what's to blame for crime, and what can be done. You know, well, what can be done with a change in morality, a change in family education, and things like that. It's just not considered a public policy issue for most people.
But given that Venezuela has one of the highest murder rates in the world, do you think, we had, of course, here in the United States a year ago, the Sandy Hook massacre, which outraged the nation, motivated the president to act, to try and put through some kind of gun control, and it totally failed because of the power of the National Rifle Association in this country. Is there going to be any kind of, you know, you mentioned earlier that there's some soul searching going on in Venezuela with the murder of this beauty queen, but is there a likelihood to be any follow-on? I mean, it sounds like with all the guns loose in that country, Venezuela is the NRA's perfect country.
Yeah, I think, you know, interestingly, there was actually, in the past couple of years, there was a very interesting effort at gun control, you know, an increase in the gun control laws and beefing up the laws, restricting the access to guns more. You know, for a couple of years, there was a presidential commissioner that came forward with a project for a new law, a proposal, a bill. And, you know, it eventually got passed, but it was seriously watered down. And in large part, it was watered down by people within the government because there's a lot of people that are in the military, you know, military officers, people in the Congress that have a lot of interests. You know, the military, for example, controls ammunition. Basically, 80% of the ammunition that's used in Venezuela is made by military industry. And so there's a lot of economic interests that, you know, want to keep easy access to guns. People that own gun shops that are in some way involved in importing guns, a lot of people have, you know, are in the military. That the government itself or people from within the government sort of, you know, really watered that law down. It made some progress, but not near as much as possible. And then I think that really gets at the whole problem within the government. On the one hand, you have some progressives that are trying to push forward some police reform and changes in institutions of citizen security. On the other hand, you have a combination of sort of leftists who think the people should be armed and military people who think that, you know, they should simply be in control of citizen security and be able to bust doors down and drag people out in the dark of the night. And so you have this, you know, there's not a real clear sense within the government about what citizen security should be about. And in fact, there's a lot of soul searching within the government and a lot of turf battles and a real conflict of interest.
Well, apparently there are quite a number of generals in this government, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of military people, mm-hmm. not necessarily generals, but there's a lot of military people that are at different levels in the government. And I think, you know, that's actually increased quite a bit during the Maduro government, which is a little surprising given that Chavez himself was a military person. But Maduro has really expanded the space given to military personnel in this government, including, for example, the whole citizen security apparatus. You know, the Ministry of the Interior and Justice, people leading the police reform are all, you know, former or active military. And so that gives it a real different flavor. You know, the whole key to, you know, the police reform that has been in progress since 2009 was to create a civilian police. You know, policing generally in Venezuela has been military. It's been, you know, police officers have military training, not civilian police training. And a lot of that's being rolled back. You know, they're going back to a sort of military model, which is going to be just as ineffective as it's always been.
Well, just in closing, David Smalley, what's happening with the opposition? They made some gains in the last election. Clearly, they're at a disadvantage not having the media access that the Chavez and Maduro and his successor Maduro have. But is there a chance that there'll be some kind of political change in Venezuela, particularly if the crime rate continues as is and citizens start to demand a more responsive government?
Yeah.
Because I understand you can't get toilet paper and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of inflation. Obviously, this is a country whose citizens, you know, are polarized between those who are fed up with this government and those that are willing to die for this government.
Right. Yeah, 2014 is going to be the first year for some time that there's going to be no elections. In fact, there shouldn't be elections again now for about a year and a half or possibly 2 years. And so it doesn't look like there's going to be any political change in terms of elections. I think, you know, the opposition in the last election did much worse than the December election, the regional or the municipal elections. They did much worse than they thought they were going to do. And, of course, they are at a big media disadvantage in the sense that they just don't have the access to broadcast media that they once had, and certainly they don't have the access the government has. You know, that said, you know, they have just so many internal conflicts and difficulties that, you know, just getting together and to a degree of unity, their message ends up being so watered down and ambiguous that people don't know what they stand for. And, you know, there's some serious battles going on within the opposition. And I think that's good because I think they need to, you know, figure out a new direction. They obviously have to come up with a different direction and actually come up with a message that captures people's attention. Because, you know, last fall, as late as late October, they were ahead in the polls, you know, despite all their media disadvantage and whatnot. But in November, the Maduro government came forward with a big sort of populist push and forced prices down. The people had to give people access to, you know, television and washing machines and things like that, which it seemed sort of like nonsensical policy, which I think it was. But it played well with the public, and the opposition had no response to this. They were just, you know, sort of hamstrung and had very little to say. And you know, people it's going to take more than what they provided for them to actually unseat the government. They have to provide an alternative, which they haven't so far.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's in Caracas, Venezuela. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and is a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela. And Professor Smalley has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and at the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He's currently writing a book called Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights under Chavez, 2008-2012, and he's also the moderator of the Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights blog. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the head of the nation's largest jail system is stepping down under a cloud.
Amor no tiene esperanza, aunque te esperará. Mi corazón se alanza, un fantasma cuerpo real. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, cause we be getting hyped to the sound. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Celeste Freeman, who is the founder and editor of Witness LA and an award-winning freelance journalist specializing in gangs, law enforcement, criminal justice, and education policy. She's the author of G-Dog and the Homeboys and is working on a new book, An American Family, about the life of a parolee, his wife and kids during his first 4 years out of prison, based on her year-long LA Weekly series of the same name. Her work has been honored by the American Library Association, the LA Press Club, the Society of Professional Journalists, and Penn USA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Celeste Freeman.
Hi, Ian. It's great to be here.
And there's been something of a surprise here with Lee Buck, 15 years head of the world's, the nation's largest jail system.
And the nation's largest sheriff's department, and, you know, and which polices a larger area than almost any law enforcement agency in the country.
And he is 71. He's stepping down. His rivals are nipping at his heels. But he's retiring under a cloud. And is there a subtext here? Is there still a possibility that this federal investigation will extend to him? Or does his stepping down preempt that possibility?
Well, this is exactly the speculation that everyone's involved with right now. None of us knows for sure. And, you know, last night there was some talk about, well, maybe there were some health problems, but that seems not to be the case at all. And the best speculation from people inside the department and people who know Baca is that it does definitely have something to do with federal investigation. What that is, you know, is all just, we're all guessing. I mean, has he taken a deal? Does he not want to be Sheriff Corona from Orange County, who, of course, was indicted while in office? And does he know bad things are coming, that he might face indictments? Or is he hoping to make a deal, or feeling that he'll be less of a target? Or is it some variation on that theme that we haven't come up with?
Well, so far, the federal investigation has federal prosecutors have filed criminal charges against 18 current and former sheriff deputies accused of beating jail inmates and even visitors and obstructing
right.
the FBI and other crimes. And there's also investigations into corruption inside of, again, the nation's largest jail system. This has all happened on his watch. I've always
definitely
gotten,
and there will be more indictments still to come. I mean, we're all but positive.
Right, but can he? How long can you claim the piano player in the whorehouse defense?
Well, you know, at some point you can't say, "Well, I didn't know." I mean, there's a point where it's no longer a sin of omission; it's a sin of commission, because to not know about a lot of the stuff that was going on either is just the most colossal incompetence, or it's deliberately looking the other way because for one reason or another you don't want to see it. And either direction you jump on that, or some combination of that, you don't have anything that's all that attractive. And when we saw corruption in the LAPD, it was as one lieutenant said to me one time, well, we generally we beat people up, but we don't take your wallet. And, you know, I mean, fortunately, you know, I mean, they're at least they're not beating people up quite as often as they used to. I mean, there's been a real change in the LAPD, but the kind of corruption we're seeing in the sheriff's department has all of that, with the brutality in the jails and the brutality that has made the department an absolute lawsuit factory in patrol. We also are seeing another kind of institutional corruption where there is an alleged pay-to-play system of promotions where loyalty and a willingness to go along, to get along, and do what certain higher-ups, particularly whether you think it's the sheriff or the former undersheriff who is running for office to become the sheriff right now.
That's Paul Tanaka.
Paul Tanaka.
Who was actually in charge of the hands-on guy with all this brutality was happening, right? But now he's blaming everything on the
on the sheriff. They're now pointing at each other.
Right.
And You know, I've never seen anything like it in more than 20 years of reporting on this sort of thing. It's the number of people inside the department or recently retired, who came to us and I'm sure, you know, a lot of other reporters who were working on this as informants. And I'd get these, you know, daily emails saying, never thought I'd talk to a reporter, but I can't stay silent any longer because the people inside the department were so upset about the corruption that they were seeing. And that to me, I've never seen before. That's unique. That suggests a corruption that is more multi-level than the kind of police brutality that we saw with the LAPD in the days of the Rampart scandal.
Again, I'm speaking with Celeste Freeman, a founder and editor of Witness LA and an award-winning freelance journalist specializing in gangs, law enforcement, criminal justice, and education policy. She's the author of G-Dog and the Homeboys and is working on a new book, An American Family, about the life of a parolee, his wife, and kids during the first 4 years out of prison, based on her year-long LA Weekly series of the same name. Her work has been honored by the American Library Association, the LA Press Club, the Society of Professional Journalists, and Penn USA. So, Celeste, for the longest time, the sheriff's jail has been a pretty forbidding place, and they're unique, at least to my understanding, in as much as they train all deputies. All deputies who join the sheriffs have to spend the first, I think, 4 or 5 years in the prison system, where they get a very jaded view of humanity, and where it appears they're encouraged to exercise brutality. This seems to be a system that I don't know who came up with this idea, but isn't that a way to sort of brutalize people? And after 5 years of this, I should think when you come out, you have, as I mentioned, a pretty jaded view of humanity.
Well, and if you add to that a catastrophic failure of leadership to set an example for these young deputies who are coming out of the academy and presumably, come out with the idea, most of them, they want to protect and serve. And as you said, you know, they're going into the jails where they're not, you know, they're dealing with the people who are either accused of breaking laws or have been convicted of them. And if then the leadership inside the jails is saying, look, the only way you can get respect and to keep control is you have to be, you know, you have to be tough, meaning, and, you know, it's okay to use excessive force. And the step beyond that is we have had these deputy gangs inside the jails where one of them, were sporting tattoos and reportedly, I mean, we heard this from a commander of the jails, that in order to get your ink, so to speak, you had to break a bone. I mean, and these are the people who are sworn to protect and serve and, you know, have badges and guns. So if that's the ethic they're learning inside the jails, then when they go out to patrol, it doesn't get any better when they're in a less protected situation. I mean, the jails are tough, but patrol is fluid. You know, it's not a controlled situation. You don't have people behind bars, and you can't walk away. So, as a consequence, then we've seen these incidents in patrol where there are questionable shootings, and or just a general run-of-the-mill violation of people's civil rights that produces a tremendous distrust in the communities that the officers are supposed to be serving, and produces great harm and lots of lawsuits. And yet, at the same time, as I said, we have all these sources, and there are all these decent cops who just want to be good cops, and they're forced into this situation of having to go along and to get along, and they don't like it.
Yeah, but that kind of culture, if you will, where it comes from. The responsibility lies at the top, surely.
Absolutely, yeah.
And when you have the FBI weighing in, and apparently the sheriff's, and I imagine that the finger eventually gets pointed at Lee Barker, they resisted putting cameras in. I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, the cameras were paid for. They were bought, and they sat in somebody's office. And, yeah, that speaks volumes of in terms of where your priorities are. And now the force statistics in the jails have come down in the last year. But it took a citizens' commission, it took horrible press, and the existence of not one but two federal investigations inside the jails with, you know, and neither one of them's over yet in order to trigger that reform. There's no reason why that couldn't have been done earlier, and, you know, a lot less harm it would have been done. And once again, that comes back to the decision of leadership.
And that commission that you mentioned was a Blue Ribbon Commission appointed by the Board of Supervisors to examine these allegations, and their report was absolutely devastating. So
it was, and one of the commissioners, Ian, was, I mean, these were not people who were naive. I mean, there were a number of federal judges and a chief of police, but one of the federal judges is Robert Bonner, who was the head of the DEA. So he's not exactly... you know, he's not your typical bleeding heart liberal, and by the end he was so enraged, and he's run for law enforcement organizations himself, and he was just incredibly shocked at what he saw.
Well, just in the last minute, Celeste, Paul Tanaka again, he's running, he's got some money behind him. How could he escape the taint if indeed he's not as dirty, or if that's the right word, as Lee Barker?
I'm not sure he can. You know, he's saying that he's the leadership that everyone needs, but there is a lot of suggestion that he'll end up indicted. You know, I don't know that, but you know that's something that certainly is being talked about. I mean, we'll have to see. You know, right now the highest-ranking person that was indicted are two lieutenants. But we understand that there's a very good possibility that not only more indictments are coming, but they're coming soon.
Well, Celeste Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Celeste Freeman, who's the founder and editor of Witness LA, an award-winning freelance journalist specializing in gangs, law enforcement, criminal justice, and education policy. She's the author of G-Dog and the Homeboys and is working on a new book, An American Family, about the life of a parolee, his wife, and kids during his first 4 years out of prison, based on her year-long LA Weekly series of the same name. Her work has been honored by the American Library Association, the LA Press Club, the Society of Professional Journalists, and Penn U.S. Essay. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.